This week on Track, we're delighted to be joined by a man of many talents, Dan Robinson. Dan is an accomplished runner with personal bests including sub 9 minutes for 3K, a 31:18 10K, a 69-minute half marathon, and a sub 2:30 marathon. Dan is also a coach with a number of years' experience with some high-achieving athletes. Alongside this, Dan has a full-time position at the University of Wolverhampton within the Sport and Exercise Science Department, in which he has particular interest in sports psychology, with a research profile centred on, amongst other topics, emotional regulation during endurance performance and psychological strategies to aid performance. Despite all of this, however, the main focus of our chat today is on a non-for-profit cafe and organisation called the Oregano Project, a project designed to provide employment opportunities and support for refugee runners and locals struggling to hold down positions that Dan is at the heart of, alongside Lucy Tate Harris, an accomplished runner in her own right. Hi, Dan, how are you?
I'm very well, Ben. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very good. Thanks, Dan. And thanks very much for taking some time out to talk to us here at Track. The main
it's
thing we want to...
It's a pleasure. Talked over you already, Ben. I've done loads of these and I should know better about timing. Sorry.
No, I know. That's probably my fault. We should have a signal. The main thing we wanted to get to really today, Dan, was a few things to try and talk about, but the main thing is the Oregano project, which we will get to soon, and it would be really interesting to hear about the conception of the idea, what it's all about, and I suppose the aims for the future. I suppose there's a little bit of an intro, though. We're going to talk about you yourself as a bit of a runner, as a coach, as a sports psychologist and a researcher, and everything else you've got going on. Okay.
Yeah, we'll try and keep this bit as brief as possible. I'm not a great fan of talking about myself, but...
No, I know you're not. So I'm going to do my best to get out some information from you.
See how we get on.
Cool. So we're recording on a Thursday afternoon, Dan. Have you done much today? Have you done your training for the day?
Not well. I've done half the training for the day. So a nice early run, whatever it was, before 7 a.m. at a very slow, half-asleep pace. And another one to do before we open up tonight with a bit of university lecturing and then kind of prep work in the cafe in between. So I'm trying to squeeze in the training as best as possible. It's not too stressful a day running wise today to race on. I think I might be racing you on Sunday actually, but I'm sure you wouldn't regard it as much of a challenge, but just tapering down for a 10. So nice and easy to service.
Great. And it's Telford 10K you've got on Sunday. I'm actually not there this year, but have you got a time in mind, or are you just about to race those around you and be competitive?
Oh, well, it's the usual thing of I've got a time in mind. Carl kind of takes a chunk off that time and tells me that's what I've got to do if I'm, you know, if I want to justify myself as a human being. And so I probably get sucked into, you know, his kind of, boxing trainer style motivational speech the night before or whatever and give it a go. But I don't know. I always find Telford a funny one because I've run well there when I've not felt particularly fit. There's all the rumours around it and it's obviously a little bit downhill, but apparently legal. So just try and jump on a massive train of guys and take advantage of that, I guess, but it's just half an hour plus in the hurt box, isn't it? You just got to try and hang on to the back of whoever you're with for as long as possible.
Yeah, for sure. And I think we saw this morning, is it 75 men under 30 minutes going into
it? Yeah. So, I think I didn't run my PB there, which was, I don't know, pretty modest, 31:18 or something, but that was... I don't know where that finished me, but it was, you know, a very, very long way down the field. So that's always good to sort of keep you aware of your place in the pecking order, I think.
Those races certainly do that. You feel like you're going okay, don't you? And then you turn up to a Telford or a Leeds Abbey Dash and you realise actually there are levels to this, aren't there?
Absolutely. And particularly both those races have got a dead turn in. So you get educated in how far behind you are as the guys come flying back in the other direction. So, they're definitely humbling, but that's a good thing, right?
A little bit like the first leg at the Sutton Park relays as well, has the same effect.
Well, that is the best race in the world, isn't it? But I'm sure we might get to that. But yeah, that's where you really find out how good you are, not some flat track bully course somewhere.
Looking ahead to the spring, are you in for anything in terms of a marathon, or are you keeping your options open at the moment?
No, I'm going to have a go at Manchester. That seems to be the one where everyone we know is going. So yeah, I'll keep hacking away at that. I'll be 42 by then. So, you know, I suppose I'll try and PB yet again, but whether or not those days are receding into the kind of depths of history now, I'm not so sure, but I'll try.
Where's your head at with your own running at the moment, Dan? Would it be fair for me to say you are less intense about your own running and getting PBs as perhaps you were years ago, or is that wrong?
No, I think that's probably right. I think I probably pick my spots a bit more than I used to. So it's definitely the case that, you know, I'm on the downward trend. I don't think I'm under any illusion about that. But at the same time, I think it's still possible to run outright PBs if you get everything absolutely right. So I managed that over the summer in the 3000 by like a couple of tenths. But I think that was exactly that. It was, you know, I'd really tried hard to focus on that event. I'd kind of had a few goes at that race as you can with that distance, and just got the perfect conditions on the perfect day. And so I need a lot more things in my favour these days, and I probably need to not go for as many targets as perhaps I used to. But you can still sort of, you know, drag one performance out every now and again, I think. So it's more just trying to be smart and not be greedy. And I think probably the time I decide, I don't want to sound like a, you know, like that boxer that goes one too many fights or whatever, but I still feel like there's the potential for a couple of PBs in there, and I'll keep at it until I kind of know that's not possible anymore. So yeah, I'll keep hacking away at it.
Yeah, and I suppose endurance sports are sports where we regularly see people of an older age still do well. So compared to your team, perhaps.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, we'll get into this, I guess, a lot about training age and all that kind of thing. And but I feel also, you know, probably for those of us that are kind of, you know, competitive club athletes, but no more than that, it's probably the cumulative life stress that has the biggest effect on how well you can do. It's you know, how many other commitments you've got. Probably, you know, a pretty rudimentary measure would be how much rest you're getting, how much sleep you're getting, would be as big a predictor of how well you're doing as anything else. So I don't think it's purely an age thing. I think it's, we've got, luckily, for me at least, we've got other things that limit us. You know, if I can try and manipulate those factors. But that being said, the thing we're here today to talk about definitely isn't conducive to additional sleep. So,
okay. So training age and a background in endurance sports for you, Dan, you started off as a cyclist, I think I'm right in saying.
My dad died of cancer 15, 16 years ago. The day after he died, I bought a bike. I'd done the usual thing, being pretty unhealthy through university. He drunk the Kool-Aid and got into Lance Armstrong's story while he was sick. And so, you know, kind of cycling seemed like a good thing to do. I just entered an event which would have been, 12 months away at the time, pretty much the week he died, and just thought, right, I'll give myself something to do for a year. And, you know, having that kind of personality, got really sucked into taking it very seriously. Ended up cycling reasonably seriously, probably through to about the age of 30, so 5-6 years. And then had to shift away because the time constraints of that were not compatible with having a full-time job particularly. And also, you know, I got into some fairly unhealthy behaviours around eating and stuff because, well, just in the pursuit of trying to go uphill quickly on a bicycle. But, you know, then that can spiral out of control, as it did for me. And so moving away from that was definitely, you know, a health decision as well.
Okay. And running was the obvious next step, was it?
Well, you're absolutely right to say, no, it wasn't. I suppose I know myself well enough, or I knew myself well enough to know that cold turkey wasn't going to be possible. So I thought, I know, I'll just do, as a sort of transition thing, I'll just do a bucket list thing. People do marathons for a bucket list thing, right? So I'll just run a marathon. I'll do one, and that will just sort of, you know, give me something to focus on that isn't cycling. And you know, that will, by the time I've done that, I'll be able to just sort of become a normal person again. I think I ran, it was in Nottingham, I think I ran 3:10 with a couple of mates. And, you know, you can sort of see where it goes. I thought, oh, 3:10, people talk about running under 3 hours as this thing. Like, oh, I wonder if I did one more, I wonder if I could go under three. So then I at 2:55, and then I thought, oh, people talk about this championship thing at London. That's 2:45. Could I get another? If I get another 10 minutes off, it seems like a lot, but you know, and you're off to the races then, aren't you? So, quite literally. So yeah, I intended it to be a one and done, and it's still not done.
So, what is it about the endurance sport that you think you were drawn to? You said about your personality. Is it? What is it that you like about the hurt and the discipline, perhaps? What do you think?
I don't want to get too serious, I guess, but I suppose for me, certainly to begin with, a lot of it was around some level of masochism, I suppose. It was around not particularly liking myself, and this being a way to express that through, you know, kind of physical suffering, which sounds pretty grim, but it's the honest answer, I think. And I'd like to believe, through a lot of reflection, that's changed over the time, and I've found, I don't want to say better, because I don't think you can really apply a judgmental kind of attitude to it, but I suppose, for me, healthier reasons to run now, and probably something closer to enjoyment. But I'm also hopefully self-aware enough to know that those sort of darker reasons still can come into it at times, and I have to, you know, often the guys around me, like with Carl's group or whoever, can be very good at pulling me up on that when I get the wrong attitude to these things.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Okay. Well, we'll try and move through, Dan, although there's loads of things we could talk for ages about, I'm sure. We'll finish off with your running, I suppose, on a high. As to, do you have a particular achievement or a moment or a race that stands out to you as a proud moment about your own running or your own achievement?
That's really hard. I always struggle with a question like that. Because I had all the usual time targets that people have, you know, and they're obviously arbitrary, but they tend to focus around numbers. I think I said to you the other night, you know, under 2 hours 30, just scrape that. Under 70 minutes for a half marathon, just scrape that. But I think probably, to a bit of a callback, I'd say my favourite ever run was my best time on the full, I won't call it the long leg, I'll call it the full leg, around Sutton Park. In the spring relays, probably outperformed myself there, I guess, in general, but certainly can't remember what year it was. It would have been just before the pandemic, I think around 2017-18, maybe it was 2018, but yeah, I think around 2017-18 for the full leg, which is, you know, by a lot of standards relatively modern, you know, so by Alex G's standards it's fairly pedestrian, but compared to my other results, it's probably, you know, the best result I've had, and it's certainly the one I care most about because of the team element, I suppose. So yeah, I'd say that one.
Perfect. So last thing then, what is it about that event that you seem to love so much?
I just, I, you know, without wanting to sound sentimental, I'm aware that, you know, we've kicked off with some very dark psychological stuff, and I don't want to go to the other extreme of being overly sentimental, but I think for me, it's just, you turn yourself inside out for your mates is a really good feeling, isn't it? And you know, carrying that responsibility without being too grandiose of you know, particularly running leg one and wanting to be as competitive as you can, even in a, you know, given that I run in a club that's certainly not competitive at the front end, but we still want to beat local rivals or whatever. And it's just, you know, you've got 11 guys following you who are kind of relying on you to do as well as possible, and that's something I enjoy, I suppose.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Dan. You're also a coach, okay, a running coach. What drew you to that? Because I may have mentioned it to you, coaching has always been something that's intriguing to me and part of it is the whole responsibility theme that I think I would struggle with if I were a coach, that sort of weight of responsibility about someone may do well or not based upon doing what I've said. Does that come into your mind at all, or is that not part of it? And what draws you to coaching more generally?
I think that absolutely does come into it. I think it's definitely one of those, I don't know what the right word is, pursuits, things you can do that can end up with an almost crippling amount of reflection at times. You know, I'm certainly someone who has been guilty of overthinking it. I think, you know, it's definitely something I feel I know a tiny amount of what I need to know about. But I also feel that, you know, the way to gather that additional knowledge is only really through doing it. So it's a really complicated thing. I also think you've got to, my current kind of view would be, and this might change or you know, with more learning, but my current view would be, it's important not to overemphasize your own importance in the situation as well, because it's a big responsibility. You can obviously, if it's done badly, you can have a negative impact, of course, and vice versa. But at the same time, I think if you start to get into the mindset of thinking how much of an influence it can be, it can take away from the idea that ultimately it's the athlete that's responsible. And the whole idea is to give the athlete ownership of everything, you know, everything in the end. I still sort of believe that you want to make yourself redundant over time, or at least, you know, increasingly turn into a sounding board for the athlete rather than somebody who's giving kind of prescriptive advice. So, yeah, that was a long, waffly answer to your question. But, yeah, I think it's a really torturous thought process you can have about, like, particularly when somebody gets injured or something happens and you review the, you know, even if it's a collaboration around the training, you review that and you can drive yourself nuts thinking, you know, should I have spotted that there was some fatigue there earlier, or, you know, whatever. That can feel not pleasant, particularly as, you know, you tend to care about the athlete a lot as well. So, but what attracted me to it, having said all that, I suppose it's that a thing of, you know, I know I've made a lot of mistakes as an athlete, and I know I've been very interested in the sport and learned as much as I can from other people in the sport. You know, we've all got kind of role models as coaches, I suppose. And I guess those two things together made me think, well, perhaps I can be of some help to some people. I think, you know, it's not necessarily going to be the case that someone's, you know, going to be right for you or the other way around. But yeah, I suppose it's just about wanting to offer some help to somebody and knowing that at times I could have done with some advice and maybe be in a position to help some people out. But I think I think the good ones are really, really, you know, humble and know how little they know. It's like in anything, like, you know, kind of the best experts are always heavily aware of how little they know and stuff. So.
For sure. Okay. And coaching, you see that as something that you're going to continue to do long into the future once you've, I don't know if you're ever going to stop running, Dan, but stop being competitive. Is that something you see yourself doing for a long time?
I think probably for me, it's best not to think in those terms because you just don't know how you're going to feel about things in the long term. I, you know, in the right circumstances, I'd love to keep doing it. I'm aware of what a massive commitment it is. I'm aware of how much, you know, I've still got to learn, and I enjoy that learning. So I'd like to believe so, but I'm also, you know, aware that it's not the best thing for me to, you know, kind of make a fixed long-term plan like that. I feel it doesn't assist me with me being any better. It's better for me to just focus on the short-term stuff.
Great. Thanks, Dan. Let's try and move seamlessly onto your sort of your other interests and passion and your work as a work at the University of Wolverhampton in the field of sports psychology. And I think I'm right in saying you're just about to finish your PhD, or you have finished your PhD in the area, working with Professor Andy Lane around this sort of idea of emotional regulation during endurance performance and all the rest of it. So can you give us a bit of an overview as to what your interests are and sort of your area of expertise and interest in that?
Yeah, I haven't finished the PhD and I need to. I think probably the thing that got me most interested initially was an attempt to kind of understand what I saw lots of people that I competed with or ran with or trained with were going through, in terms of the, you know, what I perceived at the time with kind of only lay knowledge or you know, kind of general literature knowledge, as the ability to push yourself or not. And so, you know, some people appeared to be able to push themselves harder than others, and that fascinated me, and the factors behind that and what caused that or influenced that, I suppose, was my initial attraction. It was kind of a midlife crisis to go back to university and start to look into that. And I guess, yeah, things like, not that we want to get particularly academic, but, you know, someone like Sam McCora, who's kind of tied together a lot of the older models around this, in terms of whether the limits are physical, whether the limits are psychological, and you know, as with a lot of good science, I think we probably recognise that there are elements of both, and it's a more complicated answer, which can sometimes be, I don't know, less appealing in terms of, you know, people want a nice neat bow tied around things. But yeah, I suppose it's that psychobiological model, you know, what's the interaction between the body and mind, and how much can the mind influence it, is the thing that fascinates me. And you know, I suppose ultimately it's about trying to contribute in as small a way as it will be, an understanding of how we get the mind to maximise the physical performance, and what are the best interventions and ways to, or strategies to try and help people do that in a general sporting population, I guess. So yeah, that's the bit I find fascinating, is, you know, why still, even after, you know, a few years after, is what is it about certain people that predisposes them to be able to push very, very hard, and you know, how do we understand that better?
Do you think you're one of those people, Dan, when you race?
On the right day, I think I am. And I think that's true of a lot of people. You know, I think a lot of it's environmental or a product of, you know, a multifactorial kind of set of circumstances. So, you know, where your motivation levels are, what the outcome means to you, what your overall life stress is at the time. You know, lots of things, I guess. And I suppose it's fashionable at the moment to talk in terms of, you know, you've got to be at your happiest, you've got to be at your most relaxed to perform at your best. And I think there's a lot of value to that viewpoint, but I don't think it's an absolute answer either. I think there are some people who run, you know, we probably all can cite examples in sport of people who perform really well when they're angry or when they've got a point to prove, you know, and so it, everyone's an individual in that respect in terms of what will bring the best out in them. And I guess it's circumstantial for me. I think probably on my best, probably around Sutton Park, I probably am reasonably tough. In other circumstances, you know, I'm definitely not. And other people would be much, much stronger mentally, I'm sure.
And when it comes to your coaching, trying to bring the two things together, is that as much a part of your coaching as the setting sessions and, you know, the physiological? Do you work on that side of things as much?
I think it's something in a way that I almost have to be careful of, in respect of, you know, the biggest thing in coaching is kind of the empathy with the athlete and what they want and need. And so not imposing any bias of my part in terms of, you know, a particular view of, you know, pushing very hard is desirable or whatever. I think it's, you know, you've got to be careful with that. And I try to be. But equally, you know, it's obviously the case that, well, I would say that, but I think it's reasonable to say that it's obviously the case that psychology has quite a big influence on these things, particularly I think in endurance sport, where, you know, we're not talking about particularly high fine motor skill stuff. It's you know, to some degree it's the chassis and the engine and the computer that's driving those two things. So yeah, it's bound to play a big role. I think it's more, when you come to the coaching side, it's more athlete-led. I think you're going to do better in terms of assisting with the psychology just through an understanding of the athlete, just to try and understand the person as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And would it be fair to say those things are more important as you go up the, let's say, the level of quality in athletes? So the those sorts of psychobiological aids become more important when everyone's at a more level playing field in terms of physiology, do you think? So the top guys, are they, if they're all fairly similar in terms of running economy, VO2 max, whatever it is, do you think that becomes more of a deciding factor at the top end?
Yeah, I think the very tempting thing is for me to just say a straight yes. I think, you know, it would suit me as someone who's got a particular psychological bias, if that's the case. I think there is an element of, you know, the training level of a lot of these guys. If we took the top 20 or 30 marathon runners in the world and broke down their training, we probably see an awful lot of similarities in terms of volume, in terms of intensity. Obviously, there'd be individual variations. Some people do better on lower mileage. You know, we can bore on all day about that. But I think there'd be a pretty clear correlation between being at the elite end and doing a lot of training and a reasonable percentage of that being pretty hard training. And so, yeah, I think that probably does level the playing field. And you know, you're going to see physiological similarity at that end. So, yeah, I think it can be the difference. I mean, you know, slightly thrown forward to our chat around the project and stuff. I think someone like Omar, who's the guy, you know, the first guy we've helped, I would back him in most cases where he's physiologically equivalent to the person he's racing. Mm-hmm. And we can go into a bit why, in terms of his background and what results mean to him in terms of what that might mean for his life more broadly and stuff. So, but I think, you know, yeah, that in that instance, I wouldn't want to be racing someone with his mindset for a couple hundred quid on a Sunday morning, even if I had the same kind of the same weapons at my disposal.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Dan. Let's talk about the project then. We're here to talk about the Oregano project, okay? And I'm sure you'll be able to describe it better than I can, but essentially it's a non-for-profit cafe, but also a project more widely designed to provide employment and opportunities for particularly refugee athletes and runners at the moment.
I mean, it's the obvious marriage of pizza and East African distance runners. I mean, what could be more natural, Ben? I think, I mean, obviously the name is something that running geeks like us would take an interest in. And, you know, I suppose the ultimate ambition is to get sued by the former sponsor of the group after which we're named. But trying to speak more seriously, I think the thing that really inspired it was becoming aware of that guy Omar's situation, and he's kind of the first example that I came across or came into contact with through sort of involvement in running and training. I won't say training with his group, but I mean, you know, we were rarely in the same postcode. I turned up at the same place at the same time and then didn't really see him. But, you know, I became aware of his situation and the fact that, you know, he's having a great difficulty in having his refugee or political asylum status approved, got involved with helping him with his appeal on that front, and really through that understood a little bit more about the hardship he'd gone through. And so he's a Romo tribe, so he sort of fled political persecution, which had affected a lot of his family. And you know, there are a lot of people in similar situations, and I think there's one being relatively well publicised only in the last couple of weeks, Seifu, who the running charity are supporting brilliantly. I think he was actually second behind Omar in the Reading Half Marathon, actually, so I've got the wrong guy. But I think, you know, there are a number of these people, and, you know, you might well ask, well, why focus on running, you know, for reasons greater than just that it's what I'm interested in. I think for me, it's that these guys often are role models within their communities. They can really lift up a whole community by, you know, those people seeing them flourish, and they're in a position to kind of pay it forward as well if they do well. So I think there are good reasons why we'd want to support them. And, you know, I'm keen for these guys not to be in a position where they're resting their entire future on the Achilles tendon as well. So part of what we're doing is around giving them employment skills and kind of helping them with whether it be language barrier or, you know, kind of the general admin that goes along with trying to assimilate into a strange culture.
Okay.
And put them in a position where whatever happens with their run, really, they're gonna be able to you know, be self-sufficient in the first instance, but also go on to, you know, education, employment, whatever else is needed for them to be, you know, fully participating in society here. So I think that's the aim. And you know, if they run really fast, then I'll be really excited and delighted about that. But it's not the main thing. Okay. The main thing is that they get, you know, the main thing is that they're safe and they've got somewhere to live and they've got ability to, you know, look after themselves.
Okay. Quite an undertaking then, Dan. It's got quite grand, grand's the wrong word, quite worthwhile goals there. Is that, how long in the making was this and who else is involved and what are some of the logistics that you've come up against in the journey so far?
Yeah, so it's probably been getting on for, well, certainly 18 months to actually realise a physical location and get it open.
Mm-hmm.
The main driver around getting the place open is Lucy Tate Harris, who is a far better runner than me and a brilliant masters runner. She's kind of done a hell of a lot of work around getting a location sorted, getting it kind of the logistics of it open. Obviously, we've picked a great time to try and open a hospitality business. That's certainly been a challenge, given that, you know, we were looking at venues in Birmingham, you know, kind of March, April of last year, which was the worst possible time to be trying to embark on this, and various things have, you know, held us up along the way. And we've tried to continue supporting people during that time, but actually getting a place open has been, yeah, really, really tough, actually. One of the harder things I think I've been involved in And it's largely down to Lucy that it's been done. She deserves a huge amount of credit. I mean, there's someone who's, you know, certainly mentally, in terms of her running and in terms of her approach to other aspects of life, she's a very determined, very mentally tough person. And she's kept going through this and got it done. So, you know, huge credit to her. But we've been helped by lots of other people as well, you know, and I think in general, the running community gets behind things when they see that they're worthwhile. That's been huge for us, because I think without that general sense of good work, can be very easy to get disheartened. I mean, even last week or whenever it was, we were doing initial PR for the sort of launch, and you have to go through these things and do some of these kind of slightly sort of awkward feeling publicity type things to try and just to make people aware. And inevitably, you know, that involves some social media kind of trolling or whatever goes on, you know. So you sort of reopen it up and you see virtue signaling do-gooders and what is essentially a load of racists getting on there saying, why are you helping these foreigners, you know, and making remarks about the fact that Omar's a Muslim and this kind of thing. And it's that can be on the one hand disheartening, but on the other hand it just sort of steals you to say, well, we're not going to let that sort of thing deter us from doing something that will help people.
Okay, so Omar Ahmed is the athlete, the person,
employee number one,
and I think the vast majority of our listeners, certainly Midlands based, will know Omar for his running performances. But in terms of numbers, how many people are you currently helping? How many do you hope to help? Where are you at the moment?
So we're in contact with kind of half a dozen people at the moment, and that help can range from kind of helping them get legal advice. It very much depends on where they're at along the process, really, in terms of and what their status is. And obviously we're limited by that in terms of effectively ability to work and so on and so forth. So we're stretched pretty thin in terms of trying to do a broad spectrum of things as a very small organisation. And I think we're learning quickly that we've got some gaps in the kind of knowledge and in the expertise that we've got that we need to recruit help with, which we are doing. So I think longer term, we'd like to have a sort of, you know, I think the goal is a sort of scholarship model whereby we'd have 12 to 15 on an annual basis. Those guys would, you know, as need dictates, would stay with the project until such a time as they don't need to. You know, I certainly hope that within 12 months, Omar's not one of the athletes that we're supporting because he's off, you know, maximising his bonus scheme with Hoka and you know, qualifying for major championships and everything else. So the goal is always that they outgrow us, I guess, and they, you know, and in terms of the running, they perform well enough to no longer need us. But hopefully we can act as a bit of support and a facilitating agency whilst that's going on, and whilst they're, you know, not then under pressure to chase every single, you know, 50 quid prize at every local road race or whatever, just to put food on the table. And and you know, that we probably know that, you know, that wouldn't be good for them in terms of their longer term development, and you know, allows their coaches and so on to develop them in the right way and you know, get the training right and everything else to give them the best chance of, like you said, you know, when they're competing towards the top end of these things, you don't want them to have the disadvantage of being over-raced or undernourished or you know, having a lot of real life stress on the day-to-day side of things. So I guess that, I don't know if that was a waffly answer to your question, but no. Yeah, I think that's where we are, really. It's just trying to make their lives a little bit easier and offer support where it's most needed in whatever area.
Is there a gap then, or are there issues, if we think about the running world specifically, Dan, are there gaps, are there problems in how running generally speaking, is set up to mean that a project like yours is needed, do you think?
I think if we, I mean, that's a huge question. I think taking out the refugee element just for a second and just looking at the level these guys are at, I mean, there's very little in the way of a structure for professional athletes in this country. You know, I think you and I could probably name every individual athlete that is truly full-time mm-hmm. from just doing the sport. Yeah. We might get, I don't know if we get bogged down in one or two field events, but I don't think so actually, because I think there's so few and far between, we could probably do it. And that says a lot, I think, in terms of where the sport is. It's, you know, the kind of hackneyed old analogy I use is around the Sunday league footballer versus the 4-hour, 5-hour marathon runner, mm-hmm. where the Sunday league footballer knows who's playing right back for Southampton and the 4-hour marathon runner doesn't know who won London. Mm-hmm. So we've got this disconnect between people that take part in the sport or take part in the activity, maybe, depending on how you look at it, mm-hmm. and you know, the professional side of it, or the I don't know, the elite side, I hate that word, but the elite side of it. And so I think that's always going to give us a problem in terms of, and what we don't have is, you know, a college structure that brings in a lot of support. You know, we don't have an NCAA thing that's televised live or anything like that. So there's really limited pathways for these guys to earn a living more generally, let alone if you, you know, without being too political, there's a kind of obvious disadvantage if you are fighting for a very small pool of stuff and you are also a refugee. I think that makes life even harder, because you know, you're less likely to have a social media following which might be attracted to sponsors, you know, and yeah, I don't want to get on the whole influencer hobby horse or whatever, but you know, there are certain ways in which running is monetized, and they're not always related to how fast you are.
No. Well, I mean, you spoke about London Marathon. I mean, evidently there is money in running in pockets, as we know, but maybe not in the top end of running, perhaps, definitely in this country. So is there anything that will change that? Is it role models? Is it opportunity? Is it one sponsor taking a massive punt on it? How do we get to the place where we should be, do you think? I know, a massive question.
Yeah, I know. I mean, this is like the pub ball question for athletics geeks, isn't it? I think it's really difficult, and I don't have an answer that I'm convinced by, really. I think, you know, we've got a problem in some respects, in the sense that the promotion of the sport is not separated from the governance of the sport. I think that if you look at across sports, I think that's arguably something that's a bit of a problem. You know, it's hard to be an organisation that does both of those things effectively, because there are some things that conflict within that. There are obviously at the moment limited resources to actually do that. I think we're definitely not innovative enough as a sport. And when we do try to be innovative, we seem to come up with some really bizarre ideas, like that top three nonsense in the field events and things like that, which I think, you know, everybody could see would be a disaster and really hard to understand, that the person who's done the best attempt doesn't win the competition. That's really weird. So I think it is really difficult. And unless we can find a way to connect the people that obviously do enjoy taking part, there are obviously nuanced things around that in terms of health and well-being, etc., that the reason those people take part rather than necessarily, you know, a love of the sport. But at the same time, it feels like everybody can understand the excitement of having a race, even, you know, from when you were a kid or whatever, just racing someone for distance or trying to chuck something further than the next person or jump higher or whatever it is. It feels like a sport that should be able to connect with people and should be a good viewing spectacle. And And I guess for me, the thing I always come back to is this: is the US college system, whereby you've got people invested in it as a team sport, and you know, perhaps we see a little bit of that in distance running now, just starting to emerge. You've got sort of Tim Mann and NAZ Elites and all those guys in the States who they generate a following, and perhaps people follow them because they're a member of that, the individuals because they're members of that team, and you know, maybe that's a route forward for us. But you know, the heavy investment that there has been by big companies has been, as our name suggests, has been indistinguishable from, you know, the darker aspects of the sport around, you know, drugs and everything else. And that's a huge problem in terms of trying to get wider public interest, isn't it? You know, if you look at Nike, they've you know, whatever the legalities of it, they've certainly been associated with a number of things that are, you know, questionable or have had, you know, accusations attached to them, etc. So I don't know why I'm speaking like a lawyer, but that's kind of obviously the case, isn't it? So I think when there has been big investment, it's been surrounded with, you know, the whiff of corruption and everything else. Even if you look at sort of, you know, the Diak passing away and you know, the history around that, you know, the first thing that gets said about a former president of World Athletics is that he was, you know, disgraced and heavily corrupt and everything. So I think it's a really hard job. What do you think? You're pretty thoughtful on these things. How do we improve it?
Oh yeah, I think the team aspect is one that seems to be a very good suggestion. I think you need people to be invested somehow in to care about what they're looking at. I think it's a tough one. I think role models again. I think that there's lots of, I mean, people in this country know who Mo Farah are and would perhaps watch Mo Farah. Okay. Now, like him or not, like, is a different question. So it's clear that when there is an athlete that people are somehow aware of, the support is there. So I wonder if it's how do we more properly tell people about the athletes that exist, tell the stories, advertise them and promote them in a way that makes people interested in them. And how you do that is another thing, but it's a real tough one.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. That does seem to have been the thing that's generated the biggest interest in athletics, is being kind of individual superstars, I suppose. Yeah. And you know, you look at Farah. I mean, Jess Ennis would be obviously one around the London Olympics. I think the difficulty with that is, of course, that you're resting. You know, if you think about the sport as a whole, that got carried on the back of Usain Bolt for a decade. Mm-hmm. And sorry, Ben. And the difficulty with that is, we were incredibly lucky that he didn't get any significant injuries, you know, or sort of have a Christian Coleman style drug span. Yeah. You know, not that I'm suggesting anything about that individual, but either of those things could have happened at a point when the commercial interests of the sport were hugely invested in one guy. And obviously that's dangerous, because it's a very fragile position to be in if you haven't got, again, comparing it to other sports, as much as you might have a standout individual or individuals, there's generally enough behind it that if that person was away from the sport for an extended period, it would survive. I think probably athletics would have been in even more trouble if Bolt, you know, let's say in 2011 or 2012, had suffered a sort of career-ending injury. Mm-hmm. That would have had a huge effect. And obviously, it's, you know, we could speculate as to who might have filled his shoes or whatever, but it doesn't feel like there's been a character like that within the sport for, you know, things since he's retired, certainly. And I guess that kind of approach is always going to be risky, I guess. And we got very lucky, if you view it like that, in terms of that one person being around and being so consistent for a long time and being so charismatic and everything else. So I don't know. I think, you know, you look at Tokyo and you sort of think, well, why, you know, Keely Hodgson has obviously got a huge amount of recognition and that quite rightly, you know, it's absolutely, but probably even not enough, you know, like why isn't she the biggest sports star, you know, what Emma Raducanu or whatever, why isn't Keely Hodgkinson getting that recognition, that level of, I know she got silver, but I mean, come on, you know, that's that at that age and that, and from where she's come from, and the story that's behind that as well, with, you know, Jenny Meadows and Trevor Painter, is, you know, there's such a strong narrative there around brilliant people doing things the right way that I can't believe that hasn't gotten even more. I mean, not that she hasn't got traction, but just it feels like not enough even.
Yeah. Okay. Again, we could talk and talk and talk.
I suppose. Yeah, sure.
So, I mean, just... So for people who haven't heard of the Oregano Project before, currently you're sat in the cafe, the pizzeria. Is it Albrighton Rail Station?
Yeah, it's in Albrighton, which is just a few miles outside Wolverhampton. You know, the glamorous Midlands. It's I'm always told by locals that it's Shropshire. I have to say it's Shropshire and not the Black Country. They're quite precious about that, which has probably got me in trouble with people from the Black Country. But you know.
Yeah.
That's Tipton Harriers, so I don't mind too much. I guess, yeah, it's a small venue. The intention is to roll out into some more. Certainly the next one will be in central Birmingham.
Okay.
We're kind of, we've learned a hell of a lot over the last few months of actually getting this place physically open. And as much as that's been a trial, I think it will stand us in good stead for the next one, and you know, we'll be in a much better position, hopefully. Mm-hmm. You know, depending on how Plan B and all that stuff plays out, to push on and open up some more and hopefully help some more people. But yeah, I think probably, like, even last night has caused it. Yeah. You know, at least a pause for thoughts as to what we do next.
But currently you're open for business and coffees and cakes and pizzas.
And you know, it's going well. We kind of seem to be, you know, sold out at the weekends, and you know, selling out of pizza most nights, which is a nice thing to be happening. So and we haven't yet really kind of made the impact on the running community side of things that we plan to. There's a fair bit of work to do on that. So I think we recognise that, given the location, we needed to win over the locals first. So there's been a lot of focus on that and getting them to be kind of understanding what we're doing. And certainly the plan is to try and make it, you know, as much of a running cafe as anything else. And there's various things we've got planned down the line that will achieve that, and if anybody who's racing Telford 10K wants to come afterwards and gorge themselves, they're very welcome.
Great.
I won't even, you know, it's not even exclusively for those 75 people who've run under 30 minutes.
Very kind of you, Dan.
We're very, very open to people who've run a bit slower than that, because otherwise I wouldn't get in. So
yeah. So thinking ahead, hopefully more venues, more places, similar, more athletes to help. Okay, great. And the last thing I was going to say, the Oregano Distance Project event, track event in August. Is that something? So that was at Birmingham Uni, number of track events. Is that something that you want to tie in? So putting on race events or run events?
Yeah, I think absolutely. We want to put on some more track meetings, but you know, we want to put on some road races and try and put our money or whatever it is where our mouth is in terms of doing something for the sport as well. Try and do something a little bit innovative. I know every man and his dog's putting on road races, it can seem like, but I think we've got some ideas that we're trying to develop to try and do that. And one thing I really passionately believe in is that the food at these things is not always everything we'd want it to be. So it feels like there's a niche there for us. You know, you often get the dodgy old burger van or whatever it is, which has always struck me as a bit odd when you've got a captive audience of kind of relatively healthy people who probably care a little bit about what they're eating. It's always seemed a bit strange that you've got this sort of greasy spoon offering. So maybe there's an opportunity for us at least there to improve that in running, if nothing else.
Great. Thanks, Dan. So Dan, what we're going to try and do, we're going to put this, you've had a couple of nice write-ups in various magazines and papers. So we had a write-up in the Times in Fast Running. So we'll put the links to all of that when we release the podcast. Is there anything else you want to direct people towards if they want to find out a bit more, if they're interested in getting in contact or anything like that?
You can certainly get in with, I think we've finally got our website sorted, so the oreganoproject.com should be, if it's not, it'll certainly be by the time this comes out, we'll be firing all cylinders. We shortly after that should have an app as well, which will kind of help people understand what we're doing and hopefully have some pretty cool stuff in it in terms of ways people can get involved and support if they want to. So yeah, all of that's to be got over the line in the next little while as well. So yeah, it's definitely full on, but yeah, I think most of those articles and things have been really, really good, and I'm really grateful for, you know, people like Fast Running and stuff and whoever else has certainly thrown us a bone in terms of spreading the word for us. So like I said, it's easy to focus on the negative, but actually running community can be really good, and they certainly are being at the moment in helping us out.
That's great. Thanks, Dan. What we do generally on this is we finish off with some quick fire questions. So if you're happy to do that, I'll throw some quick fire questions at you and then we'll wrap it up.
Okay? I'll try and be as brief as possible. Fire away.
Yeah. Okay. So over to you again. If you could go back in time to witness any sporting event in history, which one would you choose?
The Munich 1972 5,000 meter final.
Okay, and why that one? What's the...
Because it's like Prefontaine being super brave and Ian Stewart being very angry at himself, both of which would have been brilliant to watch.
Okay, a Birchfield Harrier much like Omar.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Very good. Okay, favourite race to compete in? Not the distance, but the specific race. You've mentioned the road relays. Is that what you...
I've said that, but I'm going to say Comrades. I think that's the best road race in the world.
And how many times have you done that, Dan?
Four.
Okay.
But I've still, yeah, that number needs to increase.
That's one of the PBs that needs to get taken down, is it?
Yeah, well, yeah, you know, it's a long way, so you can do that when you're older.
Okay. Do you have a favourite running or sport book and or film?
Book would be... I'd probably have to go with Dina Caster at the Mind Run, I think. Okay. Certainly off the top of my head. Film, running films are kind of mixed in quality, aren't they? Both the Prefontaine movies have got something about them, I think. But you know, if you want a running film, it's going to be a documentary. So, Running for Jim, about the high school coach in the US.
Yeah, great. Okay. Prefontaine's come up a couple of times. Is he someone that you like, you look to, you inspire?
I mean, he gives good meme, doesn't he, I suppose, Prefontaine. And he's got, you know, a tash that I could only dream of. So, yeah, I guess, I suppose it's just, he's an interesting character to look at in the context of where, you know, where he was when Nike was founded and what he meant to that company and what's happened to them since, I guess. So I find that whole thing really interesting.
Have you been out to Portland yourself?
Not yet. That's definitely on the bucket list for sure. In a perfect world, you know, next year when the world is on, we'll get out of there.
Great. All right, Dan. And then last but not least, of course, are you a split shorts or a half tights man?
That's so hard, isn't it? I feel like I need to say split shorts because of my age and because everything was better in the 80s. So I'll say, but then, you know, I'm an Eliud Kipchoge fan. So I'm going to say split shorts because, you know, in the 80s, everybody ran 45 minutes for 10 miles and they were all wearing split shorts. So
must have been the shorts.
Yeah, exactly.
Great. Dan, thank you so much for all your time. Congratulations on getting the project up and running. I wish you all the best for that. And hopefully, you know, perhaps in the future, we can check in again once you've sort of down the line and
yeah,
more of what you want to achieve.
Yeah, thanks for your time, Ben. I really appreciate it. Hope it wasn't too waffly, but it's really great that anyone takes an interest, and especially, you know, something like this that's kind of really, you know, exactly how I feel about running is kind of encapsulated in listening into your podcast. So thanks a lot.
Thanks, Dan. That's very kind. Just on the podcast, if you do like listening to Dan and you want to listen to Dan a bit more, Dan's done a couple of other recent podcasts. So you were on the Let the Games Begin podcast recently, episode 11, where you talk perhaps a little bit more about, I suppose, racing and coaching and just running more generally, I guess.
It was a bit of a sort of fanboy exercise for Carl Wellborn. So that might turn plenty of people on or off, I don't know, depending on their view.
Yeah, and also the Myo Mind, I think I pronounced that correctly, which
I was really pleased to do that. I think what George is doing there is really important. You know, I think disordered eating and everything that goes along with that is you know, hugely prevalent in running. And obviously, he's not a running podcast, but I think it's something that our sport still has a long way to go in understanding and working with. And so that was a real privilege to get to speak to someone who's doing such good work in that area. So yeah, even if you don't like listening to me, which is completely understandable, I would recommend that podcast and some of the much better guests on it for a good listen.
Thanks, Dan. We'll pop the links when we release this episode for those as well. Thanks, Dan. I'll let you get on with your busy day. And
thanks so much, Ben. Cheers. We'll be right back.